morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're broadcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later in the program, we're going to be hearing about a new innovative program for the environment and the youth of New Mexico. Right now, I would like to welcome our foreign correspondent, Bill Burke-White. The last time you were here, Bill, we thought that it was your very last show, but it turns out that this is your one last show before you go on to new type of work and will no longer be able to be with us. It's great to have you. Welcome to the Radio
Cafe.
Well,
I'm glad to be back. Delays have benefits, which is that I had another chance to be with you.
Well, we're glad because we want to talk about Afghanistan. I was out for dinner a couple of nights ago with three very intelligent and well-informed people, and I asked all of them, do you know what the United States is doing in Afghanistan? And all of them said, not really. So I thought, this is something that we really need to talk about. Let's talk first about the country itself. It's a landlocked country bordered by Pakistan, Iran, Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, and oddly enough, China, which is a tiny little border. It's been kind of a crossroads between East and West. Tell us about Afghanistan. What is this country linguistically, ethnically?
Well, it is a country that, as you mentioned, is kind of this crossroads, but it has a very important strategic location, but one that has made it its history quite troubled. And as you noted, it's sort of wedged between Iran on one side, Turkmenistan and China, Pakistan. But what that means is that Afghanistan is sort of stuck between various different spheres of influence. One is the Iranian-Persian Empire. Pakistan and toward India, which historically was under British control, and we'll probably talk at some point about the British involvement in Afghanistan, but also China and Russia. Even though it's not directly bordering Russia, it's bordering what were former Soviet republics, so it was trapped in this very difficult space. It's also a country of ethnic and linguistic diversity. About 40%, though there hasn't been a census in a long time, of Afghans are Pashtun, and probably around 30% are ethnically Tajik. And so there's a strong ethnic divide and then some smaller groups as well. Linguistically, most Afghans speak Persian, the Iranian language, but not all of them do at all, and for many of them it's not a first language. So many of the different tribes and ethnic clans have their own dialects and so forth. So it's a very divided country within its own ethnic groups, and then divided by these external influences. And historically, Afghanistan has fallen under the control of lots of different cultures and countries and civilizations. If you reach back far enough, Afghanistan was taken over by Genghis Khan and the Mongol empires, and then after that it had a period of independence for a little while when it was really the Afghan state in the 1700s, and then the Europeans moved in through a series of wars between Britain and Afghanistan. Of course, you'll remember at this point in the 1800s, Britain controlled India, and India was Britain's largest colony, and Pakistan was part of India. That was before the divisions between India and Pakistan. So the British controlled one of the borders with Afghanistan and sought to push inward, in part as a response to Russia, which was sort of pushing down from above. Then after the Brits left, Afghanistan had another period of independence during what was known as the Kingdom of Afghanistan. And then in the 1970s and 80s, the Soviet Union came into Afghanistan and controlled it. And it wasn't until Mikhail Gorbachev came to power in the late 1980s that the Soviets left, and Afghanistan could experience again a period of some freedom, but a very intense civil war. And I suppose we should talk more about that at some point, but the historical and political position of Afghanistan has meant that it has always essentially been fighting an internal struggle for control, as well as an external struggle for liberation from whomever at that particular moment was pushing in and trying to control or influence it.
What are the, for example, when the British were there, what did they want there?
Well, the British had, you know, primary interests in India and what was the now Pakistan, and so their major purpose of being there, or of being in the area anyway, was controlling the trade routes and so forth through India. But the British also were playing a kind of game with the Russians, who were north of there, and they wanted to control that border. You had the British also playing some internal divisions within Afghanistan, dividing tribes and so forth and creating separations within the country. So most of their objectives were geopolitical and strategic, but nonetheless, they were there and very influential in controlling the Afghan government for almost 40 or 50 years. And in the period, in that process, there were three separate wars between the British and the Afghans.
When you talk about the Afghans, it seems like there are so many different identities within Afghanistan. Is there a kind of national Afghan identity?
Not really, and that's one of the difficulties that we're dealing with today as one tries to rebuild the country. You can think of it as divided on a number of different sort of fronts. One is your ethnic divisions, which I talked about a little bit, the division between the Pashtuns, the Tajiks, and some of the smaller ethnic groups that are also in Afghanistan, the Uzbeks, the Turkmens, and others. A second division, of course, is based on clans. And there was very much a hierarchical clan structure in Afghanistan. Even, you know, Hamid Karzai, the president of Afghanistan today, comes from one of the clans that has traditionally been a ruling clan in the country. So you had clan divisions. It's also a country that's very mountainous, has zero infrastructure, so there was no united sense of terrain. Traveling around the country now is hard. It was nearly impossible 50 or 100 years ago. So there was nothing that really brought the country together. I should also mention the linguistic difficulties. About 40% of Afghans speak a version of Persian, known as Dari, but another group speak Pashto, and then a range of other more local languages. So even finding a linguistic uniform Afghan identity is very difficult.
During the after the 1979 Soviet invasion, there was basically a U.S. Cold War response, which is that they sent in covert armies, I guess, to fight against the Soviets, but they really supported the Mujahideen. Who are the Mujahideen?
Well, the Mujahideen were one of the resistance or opposition groups in Afghanistan. At this point, the Soviets are controlling Afghanistan, and so the Mujahideen were an opposition group to the Soviet occupation. And this was the period, starting at the end of the Carter administration and then really becoming prominent during the Reagan administration, that the United States fought the Cold War through proxy wars, where we would essentially supply weapons, support, and training to local groups opposed to communism or Soviet rule. We did this in Latin America. We did it in Afghanistan. We did it in Southeast Asia. So we were supplying an opposition group, but one that had a very strong Islamic identity, and that was actually also being supplied at times by the Pakistanis, who were trying to push the Soviets out as well. And it was this supply to the Mujahideen, which probably didn't have a direct effect on the Soviets leaving. That was more of a political choice by Gorbachev, but certainly did begin to create the basis for Taliban rule that ultimately led to the attacks of September 11th. So while I don't want to directly blame that policy for what happened on September 11th, we certainly did put the weapons and the training in the field in Afghanistan, supporting a very bad and corrupt government. And ultimately, after the Soviets left, the Taliban in about 1994-1995 began to form, in part as a response to the really horrible government that had followed from the Soviet occupation, and particularly the Mujahideen, you know, trying to force the Soviets out. So you know, what we do, you know, two decades ago certainly has powerful ramifications later on.
I think that's a very important point to make, because it's something that echoes in so many different stories of foreign policy. When you take the kind of the enemy of my enemy is my friend approach to things and arm them, not only does a great deal of bloodshed of innocent people occur, but it comes back to bite you.
Yeah, and there's very much, you know, a question of time horizon going on. The Reagan administration was looking at the immediate future, their electoral fortunes, and, of course, the Cold War, which was the prominent mindset at that moment in the 1980s. What, of course, they weren't thinking is what would that lead to 20 years down the line? And when you start dropping you know, weapons caches and support into countries with one set of goals, you usually can't even imagine what other consequences that might have. And certainly the Reagan administration failed to recognize the horrible consequences that we would see down the line from supporting the Mujahideen.
So the Mujahideen, what, morphed into the Taliban or was related to them in some way?
Well, the Taliban is actually a slightly different organization, but in some ways was a response to the Mujahideen. The Taliban, which the word actually means teacher or student, I guess I should say, they were a Islamic fundamentalist group supported by the Pakistani intelligence services. And they grew out of a very, very strict Islamic teachings that really have very little support in the Quran as I read it. But that they first said that their purpose was going to be to eradicate the corruption, extremism, greed that was being seen in Afghanistan as the Mujahideen were in power. They also, as I said, were supported by the Pakistanis, who wanted to create more stability in southern Afghanistan, largely so that the trade routes there would be open. And the Taliban began by sort of pushing in 1996 toward the southern cities of Kandahar. And then eventually grew into a nationwide political and religious movement. And in some ways, what the Taliban were was an attempt to return to the original concept of the Islamic caliphate, or the state in early Islam, where religion and government were the same. There was no separation. But in so doing, they brought in a series of teachings that were unsupportable and horrific from a human rights perspective. And, you know, that was the utter repression of women, the destruction of historic statues and so forth that were seen as idols and idolatry, and had a government that was very closed and really about forcing religious doctrine on the Afghan people, who, while Muslim, are not extremists by and large the way the Taliban were. So that was sort of how the Taliban came in and ultimately controlled the country from about 1996 to till the war in 2001 and 2002.
I think it also bears talking about that once the United States had kind of achieved its goal of having its Cold War goal of having the Soviet Union out of Afghanistan, and indeed the Soviet Union fell altogether and the Berlin Wall fell, that the United States ignored this war-ravaged country, and that makes a country very vulnerable when there is no longer, I mean, you send in the guns, but then afterwards you don't do any rebuilding, makes it vulnerable to extremist forms of rule.
Absolutely, and this was one of the great failures, if I may say so, of the Clinton administration, which was that when the Cold War was won, we didn't really think about what we build in its place. And I don't just mean in Afghanistan, but in many other countries around the world as well. And obviously, there were lots of countries that had been ravaged in different ways by the Cold War. Afghanistan is one where we had a particularly strong impact. But where we really failed to try to help rebuild the country. Now, obviously, if you think back to where we were in, say, 1992, 1993, Afghanistan seemed an awfully long way away, right? It wasn't until 2001 where this idea that a country 7,000 miles away could have such huge consequences here in the United States. And so I think September 11, 2001 was a wake-up call to all of us that the world is much smaller, and that even if a country is small, far away, and not very powerful, we need to make sure we're dealing with it and helping it move toward a sustainable governance and some kind of rule of law and order.
We're talking to Bill Burke White, our foreign correspondent. He is a professor of international law at the University of Pennsylvania, and we're talking about Afghanistan. So we have the Mujahideen, we have the Taliban, and we have Al-Qaeda. Where does Al-Qaeda fit into the mix?
Well, Al-Qaeda is, so the Taliban was the government of Afghanistan from 1996 to 2001. Al-Qaeda was a, or is, at that point it was a different version of what it is now, but was an extremist Islamic faction or terrorist organization, we should call it what it really was, that had received safe haven in Afghanistan. And so it was, it had an area where it was able to operate, and Al-Qaeda was able to launch the attacks that were launched against the United States in large part because the Taliban turned a blind eye or perhaps even tacitly supported what they were doing, but they were not themselves the government of Afghanistan, which the Taliban was.
So let's just talk for a moment about the term warlord. You hear about Afghan warlords. What does warlord government look like, and how does it relate, if it does at all, to a national government?
Well, I mean, that really brings us to what Afghanistan looks like today. So after the war in 2001 and 2002, there was a new government put into place in Afghanistan. I say put into place because it was really a government created by external actors, namely the United States and some of our European partners, led by a man named Hamid Karzai, who is now the president. And there was a Loya Jirga, a large sort of tribal or national convention conference in which he was named president. And he essentially runs the foreign policy of Afghanistan, but has none of the tools of governance that would let him or his government really run the country on a local basis. There's not a national police force that's strong enough to really exert itself across the country. All of the institutions of governance that you and I would think of when we go interact with government just aren't there. As a result, there are lots of local leaders across Afghanistan who really run the local governments, but they do so in ways that are not harmonized with a national policy. So if you want to drive across Afghanistan, every 10 or 15 miles you might be stopped and have to pay a toll or bribe to the local leader whose territory that road goes through. And these are people that are often called warlords, but they're, in a sense, the local government leaders whose legitimacy usually stems from the fact that they have more guns than the potential rivals, whose purpose is more to extract rents. When I say rents, I don't mean rent for your house, but to extract wealth out of the country and out of their control of the territory. And that the national government has to try to get these local governments, who don't really report to the national government, to implement policies. And some of these warlords, as we call them, are particularly brutal. Some are particularly repressive. But there is very little ability to control on a national level, policy that is occurring or implemented locally. So if you go to the police in your local town, what the police will do will depend on who the local governor or warlord is. So it's a very old and arcane system of governance, but without the tools of a modern state, it's very hard for the national government to do very much.
Let's back up a step to the 9/11 attack on the United States and the U.S. response to it. What was the U.S. response in Afghanistan?
So actually, if you recall back that far, our response was much faster in Afghanistan. Our response in Afghanistan was had much more support in the international community because we had just been attacked by Afghanistan. So we need to separate that from the war in Iraq, which was much more harder to justify and happened a little bit later. But we began a series of bombing campaigns in Afghanistan, where we attempted to support a group called the Northern Alliance, which was an opposition group from northern Afghanistan that was trying to take power away from the Taliban. And so we had a long bombing campaign there, had lots of special forces on the ground, but we didn't do what we ultimately did in Iraq, where we sent hundreds of thousands of ground troops into the country. But we did team up with the Northern Alliance, not a very savory bunch in many ways, to force the Taliban out, and then dropped in this externally organized government into Kabul, the capital. Then we forgot to follow up, right? That's where the problems really start, which is we then said, Afghanistan's done, now we're going to go to war in Iraq. But what we didn't do was provide a kind of long-term strategy to rebuild. We had some American troops in the order of 10 or 20,000 and handed off much of Afghanistan to our European partners who didn't have the resources or commitment there to do very, very hard work of rebuilding a society. And so then between, say, 2003 and 2007, Afghanistan descended from some level of stability immediately after the war into the kinds of warlords and tribal politics that you've talked about, and a reassertion of both al-Qaeda and Taliban forces that are in many ways now threatening the Afghan government that we put into place.
It just helped me understand. I mean, you have al-Qaeda. I mean, Afghanistan didn't attack the United States. Al-Qaeda attacked the United States. It was mostly hijackers from Saudi Arabia. So we attack the government that, as you put it, turned a blind eye to them, to al-Qaeda, but were not themselves al-Qaeda, and forced that government out. Was that, an effective or even rational response?
Well, let me answer that in a couple different ways. It was probably a legal response. There are some rules of international law that say that when a state allows its territory to be used by actors who cause harm to another state, knowingly and willfully allow it to be used, that those actions can be legally attributed to the government itself. And so we had a legal right to exercise self-defense under Article 51 of the UN Charter against Afghanistan. And the Taliban was a horrible, awful government. It was perhaps the most repressive, nasty regime in the world at that moment. So it was not like we were throwing out a good government. It was not a wise policy choice to think, we just throw out the bad guys, drop in some new guys, and everything will be fine. I think there were both legal and moral justifications for getting rid of the Taliban, but if we wanted to do that, it really had to be the primary commitment of the United States, and what it became was the secondary or tertiary commitment because we jumped into a war in Iraq right afterward. So one can certainly debate whether the war in Afghanistan could have been more quickly and easily won in the sense of building a stable government had we done it differently. It's hard for me to think that the world would be a better place if we had simply left the Taliban in control of Afghanistan, particularly after what they did, right after the attacks on the United States. We asked them to hand over Osama bin Laden. We asked them to do a number of things that they refused to do. And so I think the war in Afghanistan as an idea was nowhere near as horrific and convoluted as the war in Iraq, but it was very poorly implemented and executed.
One could imagine a scenario in which we didn't fight a war in Iraq in the first place because there was no real reason for doing so, and instead put that billions, if not trillion dollars, into building or assisting in building an infrastructure in Afghanistan, legal and all sorts of other ways that made it not a warlord-driven country and where there was some kind of law and order. I mean, maybe that would be imposing American style on everything,
But there are ways to do that work with local populations and build a country that really is Afghan. But had we put one-tenth of the resources and human power that we put into Iraq into Afghanistan, which is a smaller, easier country ultimately probably to have fixed, it would look very, very different today.
It does really point to the foreign policy preference that we had in the last 8 years of doing everything in a military way rather than doing other kinds of building and foreign policy.
Absolutely. We completely neglected the soft power elements of Afghanistan, rebuilding a viable state, helping to promote the development of an economy that isn't just based on poppies, right? Most of Afghans' wealth comes from opium and heroin because it's a major poppy producer. That's the economy that's developed because we didn't help build anything else. So all of those kind of building of a society and an economy, we simply forgot. And the price of that we're seeing today, which is that now Afghanistan is quickly spiraling into a much worse condition and one where we're going to have to commit many more American troops and resources in hopes of stabilizing it.
So Barack Obama walks in, having inherited not only an economy in a shambles and global warming and swine flu and things like that, but also this mess in Afghanistan. What's the policy of the Obama administration?
So the Obama administration immediately began a strategic review in Afghanistan, and in late March they released the results of that review, which suggests a pretty fundamental shift of the goals in Afghanistan. The Bush administration had really set its goals as building a democracy in Afghanistan, though they did very little to try to actually implement that. The Obama administration's objectives are considerably more modest. They are first to disrupt terrorist networks in Afghanistan and Pakistan, to degrade the ability of terrorists to launch attacks, and to promote what they call a capable, accountable, and effective government in Afghanistan. Note that the word democracy does not appear there. It's capable, accountable, and effective. They want to create governance, but not necessarily recreate a society that is truly democratic, which I think is an easier thing to do. They've also recognized the deep interconnections between Pakistan and Afghanistan, because what's happening now is that Al-Qaeda groups and Taliban groups that are operating in Afghanistan have a safe haven in northern Pakistan. So they're crossing from Afghanistan and Pakistan into Pakistan and back again. They may have been getting some support from Pakistan. So the Obama administration is really trying to deal with both issues together. Appointed Richard Holbrooke, a very serious and senior U.S. diplomat, to be the special envoy for both of those countries, trying to deal with them collectively. Then also sending in many more troops. At the moment, we have about 38,000 U.S. troops in Afghanistan. That number is supposed to increase to more than 60,000 troops, with the recognition that particularly given the geography in Afghanistan, you need more troops in the region if you're really going to try to create some stability and control. Then to also get the Pakistanis to do more. One of the developments of a meeting last week, between Obama, President Karzai, President Zardari of Pakistan, was that the Pakistanis have moved a number of their military units from the Indian border toward the tribal regions where Al-Qaeda and the Taliban have been given safe haven, again trying to sort of close in on some of these extremist groups. The other big element of the Obama strategy is really a lesson we learned in Iraq, which is that you need to reach out to and cooperate with those elements of the opposition who can be brought into a common mission or a common set of goals. And there have been efforts by the Pakistanis now to do this, which have not gone all that well, but the Pakistanis are still trying. And even in the Afghan government now trying to reach out to some of the opposition groups as well. So the U.S. is simultaneously trying to use military pressure to convince those groups that they are unlikely to win an ultimate war and to offer them incentives if they come into the governance structure that's there. So it's too early to know whether that will be successful, but that's certainly the direction the Obama administration is taking.
When you look at the example of Iraq, there's a real problem, which is that you have American soldiers ripping people out of their houses, throwing innocent people into Abu Ghraib, engaging in torture, and basically making our country seem like a bunch of brutes. And, I mean, people who weren't terrorists before are tempted to be terrorists or become terrorists because of the way we treated them. I mean, it seems like you have to do a 180-degree reversal if you're going to have any military success at all.
Well, and this was the horrible mistakes of the first part of the war in Iraq. Things got considerably better later on, say starting in about 2007, when the strategy really shifted. This is when David Petraeus came in and said, no, we cannot win the war the way we've been fighting it. We need to bring in some of the Sunnis who we can work with. We need to try to convince opposition groups that they're better off being part of the new governance structure than being opposed to it. And that was a very hard thing to do. Ultimately, it seems to have worked, though it's not clear that it will ultimately succeed in Iraq. But it's moving those lessons from the late part of the war in Iraq to Afghanistan. And one of the things that the Obama administration did last week, in fact, was to fire a very competent and capable general, General McKiernan, who was running the war in Afghanistan, and replace him with General McChrystie, who comes from the Special Operations Command, who has done much more work with these sort of questions of how do you bring in opposition groups into the fold, shall we say, from Iraq. And the other reason that probably General McKiernan was fired quite surprisingly and boldly was that there were reports of hundreds of civilian casualties from airstrikes in Afghanistan, and that his credibility amongst the Afghan people was compromised because he was no longer seen as a force for good. But some of those things that you were talking about coming from the Iraq War the bad parts of it were being seen again in Afghanistan. So the Obama administration, for the first time, I guess, since General MacArthur was fired by Truman in the Korean War, dismissed a commander in place in a war and replaced him very, very boldly last week. So we're going to see some quite powerful changes, I think, in terms of how the United States is approaching the conflict in Afghanistan.
What's the best possible outcome in your view, and is the Obama policy going in that direction?
I think that the Obama policy is correct that we have to rein in expectations. We cannot assume that Afghanistan is going to come out looking like a American-style democracy. It has never been one. It is unlikely that it will ever get there quickly. I think the goal would be a national government that is competent to administer most of the country, in which the local governments actually do follow orders from the national government, and in which there is relative rule of law and some economic activity that is not driven by poppy seeds. I think the plans laid out by the administration are the right ones to push in that direction, but there is a huge question mark as to whether it can be accomplished, how long it will take, and how many American soldiers on the ground and how much U.S. Assistance is necessary to get us there. So I think we're moving in the right direction, but we need patience and good luck.
Bill Burke White is a professor of international law at the University of Pennsylvania, and this is really his last show. We wish you tremendous luck in your new career, and we thank you so much for being our foreign correspondent all this time here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Well, I look forward to joining you again sometime in the future.
I certainly hope so. We're going to take a break right now. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome Daniel Werwath. He is with the Housing Trust here in Santa Fe, and Julio Munoz and Miguel Olivas, who are from YouthWorks. Welcome, gentlemen, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you. So at the Housing Trust, Daniel, have put together, along with other organizations in Santa Fe, a very interesting and innovative program to get young people working on energy savings.
It's exactly correct. We're launching a pilot program called Energy Works. It launches today, and what we're doing is getting youth crews out doing low-cost energy savings programs in low and moderate income households around Santa Fe.
And so this was kind of a brainstorm. You decided to you got a grant.
Well, it started because we really were looking at trying to create a program that would address a few different key issues, including green workforce development and really attacking what we see as a big issue, which is getting at the low-hanging fruit of energy efficiency.
Right.
I think, you know, energy efficiency is a subject that's on a lot of people's minds right now, and really what we're aiming to do is try and get at the easiest to do stuff. A lot of people think energy efficiency is solar panels or all these other things, but, you know, really a lot of low-cost installation stuff and a lot of like kind of habit and behavior stuff can save a lot more energy. Like, for instance, unplugging a second refrigerator can save way more energy than a photovoltaic setup. So it's one of these things where we really see a great opportunity here to kind of address a few different things, including providing good jobs and workforce training in the areas of green industry, and at the same time really working on a key affordability issue, which is long-term affordability in the form of utility bills and things like that.
I think there is this whole question of where do you save energy, and there's a lot of embodied energy in solar systems and in all sorts of things like that, whereas when you just stop using energy by doing, and you'll tell us what some of these things are, it's a much cheaper and more rational way of saving energy.
Absolutely, and it provides good jobs. It provides gateway to trade skill jobs and a lot of different opportunities. And so in doing that, we're kind of getting it, like I said, the low-hanging fruit, but also providing, a good service to the community and good opportunities for Santa Fe's young people.
So tell us about YouthWorks. The two of you, Julio and Miguel, are with this group, YouthWorks.
Yes, I just started YouthWorks, and it's I work on the energy crew, like you said, and we're just trying to help out kids like myself and Julio here that might have went the wrong direction when we were younger, and just try to get ahead more in life. And YouthWorks has really opened the doors there, really helped us out a lot doing stuff like this and getting us.
Are you in high school?
No, actually, I'm already out of school. Uh-huh. I got my GED already, and they're trying to get me an apprentice job to move up on
and
this energy stuff.
Yeah, and part of the program through this, and one of the partners in it is the community college. The kids on the YouthWorks crew, there's two youth crews that are working on this project, but also with the EarthWorks Institute. But YouthWorks has actually leveraged 6 hours of college credit as part of their green certificate program. So there's a classroom component to the project as well. So they're not just working on the houses, but they're actually doing some intensive work in classrooms, learning about energy efficiency.
What kind of work are you actually doing on the crew when you do energy efficiency?
Well, my part is doing the weather strips, which is caulking windows, sealing the doors, and that's pretty much what I do. And then my friend here, Miguel, is the plumber, so he's the one that, gets the insulation on the water heater and does the shower heads. And you waste less water that you use with regular shower heads.
Oh, right.
Yeah, so we have he's a plumber, and then I'm just pretty much like a carpenter, I guess.
Now, are you a trained plumber, or did you get training through this?
Actually, I've been doing this quite a while with my uncle. He has his own company here in Santa Fe, and I want to get my journeyman's license to move up ahead on the plumbing industry.
Excellent. Now, go ahead.
And one of the concepts here is that in getting these guys out and doing this work, eventually as this program expands, which we hope it will if the pilot's successful, we'll be working on getting the folks who are working on these crews transitioned into increasingly complex trade skill jobs and working with groups like Los Amigos, who does things like windows and more advanced stuff in the areas of energy efficiency. And several of these guys have worked with Los Amigos in the past in other internship capacities. So the idea is to kind of create a track here where we can start them with this, which is generally pretty lightweight installation stuff. The key here is that they go into the house, they perform an energy audit, where they basically look at a bunch of different parameters in the house, and then based on how that audit goes, they have about $100 worth of stuff that they can install in the house, which is, like they said, weather stripping, caulking windows and doors.
And that's super cheap. I mean, when you buy a thing, a caulk it.
Absolutely. Like I said, low-hanging fruit here. We're doing compact fluorescent light bulbs. We're doing hot water heater wraps, low-flow shower heads and faucet aerators, adjusting hot water heaters. A lot of people have improperly adjusted hot water heaters and just turning that down.
They're just on super hot all
right,
the time.
Right, you can turn it down 5 degrees and save $30, $40 a year. But then we're going to the next step and actually insulating the pipes to the hot water heater and wrapping those with thermal blankets to increase their efficiency. A lot of stuff like that's pretty common sense stuff, not typically done in a kind of package format like this. But so in doing this, we'll also be tracking the energy uses of these households. So we can go back a year from now and actually see the tangible benefits in terms of the monthly utility bill payments that people are experiencing.
So you'll really be tracking it?
Yeah, we're actually going to have something worked out with the utility companies, and the homeowners will sign a disclosure that will allow us to track their past and future energy usage and actually calculate the tangible results of this program.
Now, who qualifies for program? Whose houses are getting done?
Well, right now for the pilot program, we decided to focus on folks that had purchased homes through the Housing Trust first-time homebuyer program. And those are generally low and moderate income households here in Santa Fe. We've assisted over 1,500 families to buy homes here in Santa Fe. And we've built a lot of homes, and some of those are getting older now. And it seemed like a good opportunity, especially for a program like this in the pilot stage, to work with folks who are already familiar with our organization. And we know that there's a need there because the long-term affordability issues I mean, we can do everything we can to get people in a in an inexpensive house with a low mortgage payment, but it's really utility bills are one of the long-term risks to affordability, so our focus there.
So in the future, will you make this service available to, you know, just regular people like me and our other listeners who maybe want a home energy audit?
Absolutely. One of the things that we're trying to do here is, and the reason that one of the big ideas behind this program is, you know, this concept of the work that's most needed in the community being done by the people who most need work. And we're really trying to focus on expanding this as much as possible. And that's why, you know, working with the two youth organizations, we're hoping to be able to scale this out pretty quickly. And the pilot program hopefully will leverage funding from a variety of sources, including some of the stimulus funding that's coming out that's really heavily oriented towards green jobs training and towards energy efficiency measures. So this is kind of like a perfect storm for us in terms of what we're hoping to be able to do. And I think the state has plans to expand a program that's based on this model here in Santa Fe statewide, as the stimulus funding becomes available. So hopefully what we'll be able to do eventually is scale this out community-wide, our contacts at the city. The city is one of the funders of this pilot program, along with the community college and the Sierra Club. And, you know, in discussions with the city, I think they'd really like to see this scale out community-wide. And we'd really love to see this available to anyone in Santa Fe, because it's such an important thing. And the need in terms of the youth end of things, organizations like YouthWorks, you know, the work they do as a nonprofit, working with disadvantaged kids and providing job training and paid jobs, they have a really limitless source of kids. I mean, they can scale this out as big as it needs to go. There's kids every day, you know, 70, 80 applications sitting on
a
desk.
Is that right?
Just
My
waiting.
Goodness. Julio, how'd you get involved in the program?
Well, I started last year. A teacher told me to go and try it. So I just went and put an application and, you know, I was accepted. And then from there I got moved to another company that they were building houses and they're like totally green, all of it.
Yeah.
From bottom to top. You know, and then they stopped building houses because of the situation, you know, the bank didn't want to give any more money to them. So, I mean, I stopped working there, and then I went to Los Amigos, which I trained there for 3 months. That's how I got this time to YouthWorks, because that helped me a lot with this energy program. So, you know, I got a lot of experience in this, so that's how I got there.
And definitely this first crew, we've definitely picked guys that have a little bit of experience, and hopefully they're going to be the ones who are leaders of crews moving forward with the program and can take groups of new kids and have high-level confidence in terms of the training and that. They both have really great experience and are just really great at what they're doing, so it's a really perfect example. And hopefully, too, like, for instance, you know, like Julio saying, going to Los Amigos, you know, when we finish this program, he will have an opportunity to go work at Los Amigos, who's also does weatherization and other energy efficiency programs in Santa Fe, but they're doing increasingly complex stuff, including changing out windows and more advanced plumbing stuff, changing out appliances, so these guys will get increasingly complex trade skills and job experience.
So are you hoping to go on as a carpenter at some point?
Yeah, that's that's my goal, so yeah. That's what I'm trying to do. So probably YouthWorks hopefully helped me to get more experience, you know, and like they say, they were, I'm not done with my GED, so they're helping with me to do that. And then plus I'll probably get more credits on college so that I could go to college and then probably get a degree.
And
hopefully.
One of the great things, too, is it's not just the work experience, but also contacts in the industry. You know, for instance, you know, these guys are going to be working with various different people. You know, the Housing Trust has built over 500 homes, and we have about 80-something units of housing in construction right now. And we're increasingly working on ways to incorporate these green jobs interns into the various subcontractors that are working for us and stuff like that. Because the way the green jobs intern program works is that actually a portion of their hourly wage is funded through a grant. And so the employer only needs to pay, I think, $6 an hour or so, and then the rest of the difference between living wage and fringe is covered by this grant. So they're basically a subsidized employee for various different subcontractors and people doing home building and different things like that in the green industries. And so we have a couple interns that, for instance, with another program that are working with our construction manager. We're moving into a new building, the Housing Trust is here in July, and we're rehabbing a building. So we have two green jobs interns from YouthWorks working with our construction manager right now on the rehab of that building. And so we get discounted labor and they get job experience. It's a really win-win situation for a lot of folks.
Very interesting. So you are with the Housing Trust. The program is called Energy Works. You work with YouthWorks and EarthWorks.
Yeah, lots of works
There's
going on here.
Works.
There's a lot of work.
EarthWorks is, tell us about them.
EarthWorks Institute is another nonprofit group that works with youth here. They have another crew that's working, doing the same program. It's called the 4C, the Climate Change Conservation Corps. And it's a similar program in that they have youth from around northern New Mexico working on this crew. Same process, but we're really just building this in a kind of modular format where it can scale out as quickly as possible. And there's a central core program that can be implemented by various different types of youth conservation corps. For instance, the Energy RX crew at YouthWorks or this 4C crew with EarthWorks Institute.
So if people want to find out more information, what should they do?
Well, people can always contact me directly at the Housing Trust. My phone number there is 989-3960. To get more information, you know, we're looking for always for more support. We're looking for financial support. We're looking for technical support. Or people are just interested in trying programs like this in other communities. You can also find out more about the Housing Trust online at housingtrustonline.org, which has some of our program stuff. And we'll look for a new website within about a month now, hopefully, and we'll have some detailed information about this program. You can also find out more about YouthWorks at their website, which is santafeyouthworks.com, and EarthWorks Institute, earthworksinstitute.org. So there's a bunch of people involved in this, and we're really excited about it. It seems to be kind of a perfect storm for what's going on right now, and we really hope that more people in the community are going to get involved and get educated about this.
Daniel Werweth is with the Housing Trust here in Santa Fe. Julio Munoz and Miguel Olivas are from YouthWorks. Thank you all so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We are podcasting at the website santaferadiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, the Colors of Jazz.